Inflation is a thing in the U.S. in a way it hasn't been for decades, driving more voters to the polls than hot-button issues like abortion and health care. Many of us wonder if we can keep stretching our paychecks to cover things we really can't cut out of our budgets, food, rent, transportation. And as central banks like the Federal Reserve step in to raise interest rates, we also worry that fixing inflation could trigger a recession. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Kenneth S. Rogoff is here to talk about why this decade is shaping up to be the most challenging era for central bankers since the 1970s. He was chief economist at the International Monetary Fund from 2001 to 2003 and is now professor of economics at Harvard University and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His recent article for Foreign Affairs is called The Age of Inflation. Ken, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
We should start by noting, as bad as things are right now in the U.S. and Europe, inflation is vastly worse in some developing economies like Argentina and Turkey. How much does U.S. fiscal policy affect what happens in emerging markets?
U.S. policy certainly matters. So, for example, when the dollar's strong, that puts inflationary pressures on them. When interest rates go up, and fiscal policy is a piece of that, along with monetary policy, that puts pressure on them. You named Turkey and Argentina. I would describe their inflation as own goals. I mean, when you kick the ball into your own goal in soccer, I mean, they've just made some just crazy decisions over the past few years, particularly Turkey. Argentina's inflation rates at 100%, Turkey's at 80%, but I don't think that's the benchmark of comparison for us. Although it is worth noting, that sort of thing also has not happened for a long time.
Voters in this country understandably put inflation at or near the top of their list of concerns when they're choosing candidates. How much control do Congress and the president actually have over what happens with something like consumer prices?
Well, I think there are a lot of players involved in making this happen. First of all of us, because we just got euphoric after the pandemic, and we had a lot of money put in our pockets by all these stimulus packages. Certainly, the end of the Trump administration threw a lot more money in when it wasn't obvious it was needed. And then the Biden administration did much, much more pouring money in. That's put a lot of inflationary pressures. The Federal Reserve does have the instruments to quash it, although at great risk, as you noted at the outset. I will say, though, that I also put blame on the economics profession because many, many people insisted we hadn't had inflation in 30 years. It didn't matter if debt went to the moon. It didn't matter what spending you did. We just wouldn't have it. And they were proved very wrong.
So it wasn't just regular people who got lulled into a sense of false security.
No, absolutely not. I mean, they take polls every year at the meetings of the American Economic Association. And, you know, they poll a few hundred people, and you can sort of trace out the, I would say, pretty sharp shift to the left in thinking. And one of the views was, well, you could just spend a lot more money on social policies and whatever you wanted. And if you could raise taxes on the rich, that's great. But if you couldn't, it didn't matter. It would still be just fine because interest rates will be zero forever. Inflation will be zero forever. And of course, that was stupefyingly naive, and we shouldn't have seen that in the economics profession, but we did. So no, it's by no means just ordinary people. I think a lot of people were caught off guard.
Let's get just a little bit of context here. Many people will have heard, and some of us can directly recall, how bad inflation was in the U.S. in the 1970s. What finally worked to bring all those years of dramatic price increases under control?
So we did indeed have, so far, much worse than the 1970s. So we hit around 9%. I think inflation's 8% now. In the 70s, it went to 14%. But it was 6% or more for, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years. It was really a very long time. And it was caused by a number of things. The oil prices shot up, many things. But certainly the thing that finally quashed it was the Federal Reserve, with great determination, raised interest rates. So right now, the Fed's talking about raising interest rates to 4%. They were raised to nearly 20% in the 1970s before inflation finally started coming down. I don't think we're going to get to that here, but it gives you an idea of why policymakers get so scared when they see inflation slip out of control.
I hear a number like that, and I wonder how, for instance, my parents bought their first house in the early 70s. I mean, these were really challenging economic times for everyday middle class people.
They were, mind you, if your parents bought their house early enough in the 70s, they didn't pay 18%. The interest rates went up very slowly. They were probably paying 6% or 7%. And the inflation made the house prices eventually shoot up a lot. So they didn't necessarily lose. But indeed, for ordinary Americans, just like you're feeling now, wages weren't keeping up with inflation, and it was making you poorer. And that's certainly happening to some extent now. The wages are moving up, but not as fast as inflation.
So everyone understands the pandemic caused some enormous upheavals in economies that had been humming along pretty well. Tell us, Ken, what were some of the specific ways that COVID disrupted the global economy?
Well, for sure, one of the things it did was sort of upset the whole geopolitical order. It's not just the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has been one of the factors making oil go up. It's one of the factors making food prices go up. It also had a profound effect on China. They're still in COVID lockdown. I don't know how many of your listeners know that. And China has really faded as an economic power for the moment. And that's actually had a big impact on inflation, because they're very involved in all kinds of production chains. And they're still making stuff, but it's much harder and more expensive. And I would say also, because of the pandemic, it was just sort of hard to know what was around the corner. We hadn't seen anything like it really in modern times, maybe 100 years ago. And so I think nobody quite knew how to calibrate the response. I think it was certainly the right thing to do to protect people, to freely spend money, to freely run debt. What do you have the ability to run debt for? It's for a rainy day, and the pandemic was a disaster. But I think there were mistakes made at the end of it, where people got, a little, I don't know the word for it, but too happy with how much voters liked having stimulus checks passed out. And that's absolutely a piece of what we've experienced. And I think, there's some debate about exactly what percent, but I would say half of it was because of all the stimulus we did at the end.
So we had two different presidents doing pretty large stimulus packages. Let's take these each in turn. What effect did the Trump stimulus expenditures have on the economy at that time?
Well, I mean, a lot of the early stimulus was, we need it. The economy, I don't know, employment collapsed like we haven't seen since the Great Depression. We were locked in our houses. People couldn't earn money. A lot of people were in desperate straits. That was a good idea to hand out money. And it was, I think, bipartisan that we did that. I will note that when Trump lost the election, but he was still a lame duck president, even if he wouldn't admit it, he realized Biden was going to come in wanting to spend a lot of money. And he did something that, you have to give the devil his due. It was strategically very clever. He did a $900 billion stimulus late in the game. Not clear we needed it, but maybe we did, maybe we didn't. And I think that put Biden into a corner, because then he had to come in spending even more in order to feel like there was a change. And he did his, I don't know, $1.8, $1.9 billion stimulus. And that's not even counting the, I'm sorry, trillion, right? A billion here, a billion there, and you're talking about real money, is the saying. No, it's $1 trillion, the stimulus. And then they spent trillions more. And that absolutely put pressure. Now, the Federal Reserve could have nipped it in the bud, but a point I've tried to emphasize is that was kind of hard for them politically because the Biden administration believed that it would not cause inflation. I think he lined up 17 Nobel Prize winners to say that it wouldn't cause inflation. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the economics profession, I would not include myself, but a lot of the economics profession said it wouldn't be a problem. And for the Federal Reserve to step in and say, well, we think we're smarter than everyone else. Even though we haven't seen inflation in 3 decades, we're going to start raising interest rates, even though it might hurt this whole recovery. So they certainly had their reasons to lay back. It's a complicated world. As I said, there are a lot of people to blame.
And then, as all this extra money is floating around the economy, people can't spend a lot of money on services, so they want to buy stuff. And there are these ongoing shortages of goods to buy and sell because of the pandemic.
Well, that's very well put. So if we all have our pockets lined with stimulus checks, but we're still scared to go out to a restaurant, then people buy more of imports and manufactured goods than they would. And as I said, China was having trouble making them. There were a lot of lockdowns and it bit up the price. But that was just the first stage. Then, as the economy opened up, but the stimulus continued, then it started filtering into everything. And unfortunately, that's where we are now.
What is a supply shock and what is a demand shock? We think they must go together, but they don't necessarily.
It's a great question. So, a good example of a demand shock was too much stimulus. You give everybody a lot of money, they're going to go spend it. Obviously, it's going to cause inflation. And if there's some room for the economy to grow, it'll cause the economy to grow. So the answer to that is the Federal Reserve should raise interest rates, which pushes back on both. But supply shocks, for example, oil prices go way up because of the war in Ukraine. Supply chains break down, so you can't get goods as quickly. That's just bad. It's causing a recessionary tendency, output's going to be lower, but at the same time, it's making prices go up. And there's no easy answer to that. Like a stimulus, for example, will just, help with the output side, but it'll make prices go up more. If the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, which we'll come to talking about, that will cause people to scale back. That's good for inflation, but it's bad for the recession. And it really only since the 1970s that we've been faced with this kind of dilemma, and it's very difficult to deal with. It's more fun to be in a situation where things are growing smoothly and occasionally, there's a perturbation and you kind of deal with it than dealing with these situations where I mentioned Ukraine, what's going on in China. And the pandemic is not a pure demand shock. It clearly affected how we could supply things. So it's been a very difficult period. And I suspect we're headed for a very difficult period for a long time to come. I think the days when the Federal Reserve was lauded for how nicely it controlled inflation and, keeping interest rate policy really smooth. Unfortunately, they're going to have a lot harder public relations troubles now just because they're going to have to be delivering bad news. They're going to have to be raising interest rates sometimes when people really, really don't want it.
And plenty of people fell out of love with the Fed and central banking in general, after the 2008 financial crisis, right?
Well, yeah, but I think they fell out of love with, just in general, the system. So that's certainly a big part of the political movement. and they were, angry at the banks and they were angry at Congress. I think at least, technocrats thought the Fed did a good job given the situation. We can debate that, but you're right. I mean, there's certainly a movement, particularly on the left, to take away Federal Reserve independence. That's been a cornerstone of our whole financial and macroeconomic system that we've had at least since World War II. And there's a view we should just, the Treasury should just tell the Fed what to do. And the progressives, which I think populate the Biden administration, a lot of their leading thinkers have this idea, will run a lot of deficits for social programs and infrastructure and improving the climate, and we'll just have the Fed buy it up by printing money, and it won't cause any inflation. There was this idea going around called modern monetary theory, and you can find puff pieces in the New York Times as recently as earlier this year, incredibly enough, about it. I mean, I don't think you have to explain to ordinary people that that sounds kind of risky, but that was part of making the Fed not independent. Your job's just to print money to pay for the deficits we want to run, which is, of course, what they do in countries like Argentina and Turkey and Venezuela. We don't do that here. It didn't matter when interest rates were zero because it just didn't matter how they were financing the debt. But now that interest rates are rising, you can see that that would be kind of crazy. We'd get whatever inflation we have now, it would get a lot worse.
So, at some point in recent years, the Fed settled on 2% as a kind of ideal target for annual price increases for inflation. I'm glad to have you here because you can answer for me. Is there science behind that number? Why is 2% preferable to 1% or 3%?
Well, the short answer is not so much. But I think what the real idea was is you want to be predictable. What are you trying to do? And so by identifying what inflation you're anchoring yourself at, it's not their only target, because in the Fed's mandate, explicitly, they're supposed to try to create maximum employment, whatever that means, but they're supposed to look at employment. But 2% was picked because there's a variety of technical reasons. One is that it's very hard to account for new goods, which make us better off. And so probably, inflation's a bit of an illusion. Small inflation's a bit of an illusion. Also, there's constantly changing. First, there was Walmarts and big box stores. Then there was the internet and ways people could buy things cheaper. So there was a feeling that 2% was sort of the moral equivalent of zero, if that makes any sense. But the important thing really was just to be predictable. You would try to say what you're doing. I think that got carried too far myself. I think they sort of fell in love with their communication strategy and felt, we're going to tell people what the interest rate is going to be. We're going to tell people what the inflation rate's going to be. And the problem is, it's very hard to predict, because in a world where things are quiet, which we've had some episodes of, well, that works fine. But when you have the pandemic, when you have the war in Ukraine, when you have, unprecedented fiscal stimulus, it's hard to know what's around the corner. And so I think going forward, I would hope the Fed kind of is more cautious, like it used to be in the 80s and 90s. Alan Greenspan was the chair of the Federal Reserve from the late 80s through the early 2000s. And this is facetious, but he sometimes said, if you understood what I'm saying, I must have misspoken, because he wanted to be non-transparent.
So your sense is that the Fed should have stepped in much earlier to slow down the inflationary effects of the stimulus by increasing interest rates. And the way interest rates work to do this is that they slow consumer demand by making borrowing less attractive and then making it more attractive to just save money, store it away.
Yeah, I mean, also anyone who has a 401k or any kind of stocks or anything knows that when interest rates go up, it cuts the value of everything from Bitcoin to art to houses to you name it. And that makes people's wealth go down. It doesn't lead to a sudden collapse in spending, but it does have an effect. It makes it, it certainly makes it less attractive to do investment projects when interest rates go up. It doesn't necessarily just make everybody decide to change their mind, but yet it definitely has a strong effect. That's what the idea is. But I want to come back to, was it the Fed's fault? I think that's a tremendous overstatement because, again, they were being told by the leaders of the Fed were being told by their staff that probably there wouldn't be inflation. The economics profession, there were only fringes of us who were saying there would be inflation. And most importantly, I think the Biden administration, the progressives swept into Washington believing they had a mandate and they had ideas of how to improve lives and stimulate the economy and make things better. And the Fed would have sort of been a party pooper to come in and say, well, this is all great, but if you're not going to raise taxes to pay for all this, we're going to have inflation. And I'm sorry, we're going to have to raise interest rates. That was very, very politically difficult to do, especially when so many leading thinkers are saying, don't worry about it. Famously, Paul Krugman at the New York Times, who's a Nobel Prize winner, really, really dug his heels in saying there just wouldn't be inflation. It's just not going to happen. He almost hasn't given up yet. And so it wasn't easy, but of course, that's their job. And in hindsight, yes, they should have raised interest rates sooner. We'd have had less inflation. We'd have had less growth, too.
You know that Jerome Powell, Fed chairman, may have been motivated to delay acting on interest rates because he wanted to keep his job.
Yes, that's also true. So what I said about, not being sure if inflation was going to come and everyone said it wouldn't happen kind of explains most of what happened last year. That's when things really got out of hand. But it is also true that he did want to get reappointed. He knew the Biden administration would not like it if he raised interest rates. And I would say that had he raised interest rates, he almost surely would not have been reappointed, especially because Lael Brainard was a very strong alternative who had a reputation in the market of being much more, we say, dovish, much more inclined to keep interest rates down. And I think everyone knew that if Powell started raising interest rates, he would have got the boot, she would have got the job, and you wouldn't have ended up raising interest rates that much anyway. So what I say in my article is that the Biden administration has said later, well, we wanted them to raise interest rates. That's on them. That's not our fault. Well, if they really felt that way, then President Biden should have appointed Powell in the summer of 2021, not at the end of 2021. And then I think had he done that, Powell would have felt comfortable to start raising interest rates. Of course, he didn't raise interest rates the day he was appointed, but pretty quickly afterwards, he started on it.
So it was like he was biding his time until it was safe for him to do that.
Yeah, although, just I'm looking at the other side of it too, that had he raised interest rates, it wouldn't have done much because he would have gotten the boot and markets would have rightly expected that a team would have been brought in by the Biden administration that didn't raise interest rates. So at that particular moment in time, the Fed's independence was much weaker because actually not only was Jerome Powell up for reappointment, but a couple other seats on the board were also up for reappointment. So again, there's a lot of people to blame. And I think the extreme, by the way, one extreme President Biden points to and had used to is it's Putin's inflation. Putin caused it with the invasion. And he certainly caused him, Putin caused a mess. Putin has contributed mightily to the inflation. But we had the inflation long before Putin invaded Ukraine.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Steve is on the line in Irving, Texas. Hi, Steve. Hi, Steve, are you with us? Okay, let's move on to Sunday in Fort Worth. Hi, Sunday.
Yes, ma'am. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you and the professor for the engaging conversation. I have a question. From what he's saying, my understanding is that he's saying that inflation is better prevented than controlled. And now that we are in this enormous mess, businesses are doing their own things to make certain safeguards for individual consumers like us. If you're contemplating a major investment, like maybe buy a new home, what would be the appropriate, reasonable precaution? They say what goes up must come down. Do we keep waiting forever or just make the move?
Thanks for your call. What about that in general terms, Ken? I know you can't give direct advice to Sunday, but people who are, you know, on the precipice of a big purchase like a house, what should they be thinking about right now?
Boy, that's a very tough question. I will mention one thing I feel some confidence in saying, which is you know, stock prices have come down a ton. Housing prices tend to move much more slowly. They are coming down. There's so much evidence. I think they've been downward pressures actually for almost a year now, because everybody sees the interest rates going up. And what happens in the housing market is the seller says, well, why? My house was worth more yesterday. I don't want to sell it for less. And the buyer's saying, well, housing prices are going down. I'm going to give you a lower offer than you're asking for. So I think if you're doing a big purchase like a house, you need to be pretty sure, you know, that you're know what you want to do. It's very hard to get the timing, but I would say there's downward pressure on housing prices. It had been a seller's market up until certainly a year ago, and the tables have really turned, and you know, bear that in mind. More generally, I don't think the inflation's going away. I think it's going to go down. And the trouble is some things may go down more, some things may go up more. But I think the inflation's going to be with us for some time to come. The prices are not likely to reverse. It's just to slow down on how fast they go up.
Plenty of Americans, of course, don't have money in the stock market. But for those who do, especially for those whose retirement savings are there, we should note that these effects on investment markets, they're not permanent, right? How long does it typically take for those kinds of investments to recover?
Boy, so it's a little out of my depth to give financial, wealth management advice. But I'll tell you, what I think, which is it's hard to know when it's going to come back. The market has rebounded quite a bit in the past, last month. That was surprising because it had gone down a lot. It's very hard to predict. But something I think I do understand is that one of the factors driving markets up relentlessly after the financial crisis was that interest rates were so low. What are you going to invest in? What, if you're holding a bond, you're crazy. The interest rate's almost nothing. You don't make anything. So I think a lot of people went into anything, not just stocks, but housing, cryptocurrencies, what have you. And unfortunately, interest rates, they're not only going up, I think they're going to stay high for a long time to come. I think this period where the interest rate was even lower than the inflation rate, I think it's over. I'm just giving you my view. And so that part is not good. On the other hand, maybe we won't have a recession. That'll be good for the market. Hard to predict, but it's mostly if you just invested in the stock market last year, you lost. I mean, that's terrible. But on the other hand, if you invested 10 years ago, You made a lot of money, you've given some of it back.
Ken, you note in the piece that negative interest rate policy might have given the Fed a useful amount of flexibility to act earlier and preemptively to curb inflation. First off, explain what negative interest rate policy is.
I don't want to make your listeners' heads spin, but many countries have experimented with the idea of actually charging banks a fee to hold their reserves at the central bank, that the central bank is the bank's bank. And the idea is to make them want to spend it so that when you're pumping money out, they want to lend it out and not have it being taxed, basically sitting at the Fed. And we've been reluctant to go there. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a, is sort of a long story, but I think part of the reason the Fed was so reluctant to raise interest rates was because they were worried that if it led to a recession, interest rates would then slam back to zero and they wouldn't have a way to stimulate the economy. And what do you do if you raise interest rates, cause a recession, and then you bring interest rates back down, but it's not enough to get you out of the recession? What do they do? And over the past 12, 14 years, central banks have tried all these creative things to try to get around this problem. Because, of course, I think as many of your listeners know, interest rates were really low. And my opinion, I have a book about this, is that nothing worked very well. It didn't work at all. And that's why, you know, we had such, part of why we had such slow growth and inflation was practically zero when they wanted it to be 2%. So if they had a tool that could make, that they could deal with, what if they got things wrong, it would give them more courage. Part of the reason they did not raise interest rates is they said, well, if there's inflation, we know what to do. We raise interest rates. But if it crashes down and there's zero inflation recession, we don't know what to do. They certainly got half of this wrong because we now have inflation and we can see clearly they shouldn't have been so sure that they knew how to handle it. But I think long-term, they need a tool for trying to stimulate the economy when it's down. Now, many people said, just spend money, just, you know, send out transfers, have the government spend a lot of money. The trouble is that that's sort of a political free-for-all. And I, you know, it has no discipline. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in March 2021 when the Biden administration put in a very politically motivated stimulus. It was openly so. They weren't saying anything otherwise. And that's part of how we got too much inflation. So the Fed not only needs tools and courage to fight inflation when it goes up, but it also needs a tool to fight a deep recession, a pandemic, a financial crisis when things are really bad. And we're still lacking that. So I'd invite, you know, people to think about this idea. I've written about it. It sounds kind of crazy having a negative interest rate. I will say, because it creates growth and because it creates inflation, it's only really the really short loans. In fact, the loans that the central bank borrows from the banks are one-day loans. But if you're looking at 10-year rates, for which are the big rates for most of the economy, looking at mortgages, those interest rates would probably go up and not go down. Anyway, it's a tool. I think they need to do something so this doesn't happen again.
So there are ways, even using negative interest rate policy, to avoid incentivizing companies, certainly even individuals, from, you know, withdrawing all their money and keeping cash in a suitcase under their bed.
Well, that, yes, and there are ways to handle that, and basically there, you know, one way that I think is pretty simple and anyone can understand is you sort of phase out $50 and $100 bills over some period, because, you know, you don't really care if one of your listeners in Northern Texas has $10,000 under their bed. It's not going to affect anything big going on and how central bank policies is working. But on the other hand, if a big bank, Citibank or Bank of America or JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley, if one of them takes out tens of billions of dollars in cash and stores it in a mountainside in West Virginia, that has a big effect. So you need to make that expensive and difficult. It's and there are ways to do it. There are also ways to do it having to do with having the rate at which the central bank pays for cash depreciate over time that create the right incentives. It's an ease compared to the kind of problems we're in, it's an easily solved problem.
We have an email here from Pam who wants to know, the stimulus lifted up so many people financially, but now inflation is hitting folks with lower to middle incomes hard. Is there no way to provide government financial assistance to the population without triggering ill effects later on?
So I think this is like a lot of government programs where you need to make it popular. Clearly, you want to, the International Monetary Fund is saying, and I think very sensibly, you don't have as much money to spend now because of inflation and all these deficits are causing inflation, but you still need to target money at people of low income, lower middle income people. You need to target them. But of course, all the stimulus packages basically gave away money to everybody. So you created unnecessary inflation. Now, it's more popular, and I think it was very deliberate. Bernie Sanders, I think, was very conscious that he was the architect of the stimulus policy in 2021, and he more or less stated that it needs to have the support of the middle class. We have to give money to everybody. Well, you can't. I mean, you can't. You have to try to decide what your priorities are. And I think that was a mistake. And again, it wasn't just Congress. It wasn't just the president. There are all too many economists who thought you could do this with few repercussions.
So can I assume that you are not one of those people on board with the idea that something like a universal basic income could actually work?
I'm in favor of transfer payments to poor and low income people. And I think actually that kind of way of giving money out is actually a very good idea. But of course, you can't just give it blanket to everybody because then you have to raise taxes to pay for it. So it has to be targeted. I mean, food stamps, at least in my view, are sort of an ideal program where it's pretty close to giving money to people. I think it's been very successful. So the idea that if your income's really low, we're just gonna give you money, I support that. But it can't go up to somebody earning $100,000 or $200,000. That's just irresponsible.
So we're waiting now on the announcement of another 0.75% hike in interest rates. I thought it might happen while you and I were talking, but so far that hasn't happened. How appropriate do you think it is that these are happening now in chunks that big? And is that sort of an appropriate amount by which to raise interest rates at a time now for the Fed?
So, you know, there's a lot of positioning and controlling people's expectations. And if the Fed doesn't do what it's indicated it's going to do, it's going to confuse everybody. But the short answer is I think there are all these people cheerleading the Fed to quash inflation as fast as they can. And you screwed up allowing inflation to get high. Now you've got to stop it. And I worry very much that they might go too far in the other direction. And the reason it's difficult to navigate is that when you raise the interest rate, it hits the stock market right away. But if you look at things like employment, output, it can take a year. It can take 2 years. So it's a little bit like you're driving a car and you have to push your foot on the brake 1,000 or 2,000 yards before you want to stop. and you don't even quite know what's coming up. And that's a reason to kind of do it more slowly. So I would favor they try, get rid of inflation slowly, but they need to take their time. It could take years to do it in a careful, sensible way. I actually think that's what they will end up doing. I think they'll slow down. I think inflation will linger at 3 or 4% for years, but that is, better than crashing the economy into a super deep recession, especially now. We just had the pandemic. We just had the financial crisis not so long before that. The last thing we need is a deep recession, not just for ordinary people, but imagine the effect on our politics.
So, how are investors bracing themselves for the kinds of conditions that you've described? And I wonder if you were sort of among a minority in the beginning saying we need to watch out for inflation here, you're no longer, lots of people now, lots of experts are in your camp. How universal is the understanding of what's to come?
Well, I think there's a lot of disagreement about it. So I think my colleague Larry Summers has been incredibly prescient all the way about this. And he states, and I think correctly, that it's very hard to engineer a soft landing to this kind of inflation. What that means, it's very hard to bring the inflation down without bringing the economy down with it. And my conclusion from that, I don't know if it's necessarily his, but my conclusion is I'd rather have inflation at 4% for a few years and take our time bringing it down than try to bring it down all at once. Chris, you asked at the beginning, why 2%? Well, there's not a really good answer to that. And you don't want to, I'm not saying it should permanently be 4% because it's too confusing, but I think if you look at sort of the cost benefit, having it, to me, having a deep recession now following so close to what we've just been through would just be tragic, and the ramifications very, very hard to predict.
Do you have any thoughts just personally on how people running things at the Fed or at any central bank can avoid the pitfalls of groupthink?
That is a great question, and I think one that needs to be raised more. They have gone through this period where they're constantly reinforcing everybody, saying, good job, we all have to fight inflation, we're all doing the same thing. And of course, they all got this wrong together. And they all felt that, inflation would come down. And I think, hopefully they won't all cause a recession together, but I don't know. There's a real risk that we're not just getting a recession in the US, but something that could be worldwide.
What does it take to have developed for yourself the courage to stand out alone, at least in the beginning of things, and raise the red flag?
Well, I'm an academic, and so we're supposed to think outside the box. I've been making the point for a long time that debt may seem a free lunch, but that's only because interest rates are very low. They will likely go up at some point, and your debt doesn't go away, and suddenly it could become very painful. And I've certainly people think that's horrible. The government should spend on everybody when they can. And what we call economics the dismal science sometimes, because we have to raise the possibility that there are these tough trade-offs. And sometimes people don't want to hear it and makes people angry. But you try to stick by what your logic was, and I try to do that.
Kenneth Rogoff is professor of economics at Harvard and chief economist, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. His article for Foreign Affairs is called The Age of Inflation. Ken, I feel like I understand this a lot better than I did going in. Thanks so much for talking this through with us.
Thank you for all your great questions, and to your listener for a great question also.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.